for our program, which is made possible by the Burton D. Morgan Center for Entrepreneurship Research and our Hudson Library and Historical Society. Tonight, we have Mark Wiseman with us. Mr. Wiseman has practiced law for over 25 years, first in a large multi-state firm, later as a partner in several firms. He currently manages Wiseman Legal Associates, which is here in Hudson, and he handles mostly small business legal needs, family needs, formation of and counseling to business entities, commercial litigation, and general needs such as wills, estates, real estate, and contracts. He also has been a former prosecutor and served as an assistant law director for Stowe, Ohio. He has training as a legal mediator, has also been an arbitrator and a special prosecutor. He regularly is in municipal common pleas, domestic probate, and appellate courts throughout Northeast Ohio. He's also presented continuing legal education for law schools and the bar associations. He's also taught at the university level and served as a deputy county auditor while attending law school at night. He's been pretty busy, so we're glad to have him here tonight. Without further ado, Mr. Mark Wiseman.
Thank you. Thank you, Julia. And I want to, for the benefit of all of you, just thank Julia. She's done a great job, and I've talked to other people that have been attendees at these programs, and she puts a lot of effort into it. And so I'd like to give her a little shout-out, as they say. I want to thank those of you that are here for being here. It's obviously spring break in Hudson when it's kind of like an evacuation. So I'm surprised there are as many people as there are here. But it's the good side is there's no traffic. So. What I want to talk about tonight are, just as the title says, avoiding costly mistakes. A lot of the businesses, a lot of my practice over the last 27 years has been small mom and pop, small family, and small corporate businesses. And when I say small, I'm talking about from one person up to probably my largest long-term client has about 40 employees. Does about $70, $80 million a year in business. Always on the verge of outgrowing me because I'm a small business. I'm a small office now. But I work with a number of associates and people outside of my firm to provide other services. In fact, I think one of the programs that was here a week or two ago, or maybe it's coming up, is talked about building an advisory team or having a group. And that's I'm a big advocate of that. And whenever I have new clients, for example, or expanding clients with small businesses, I always strongly urge them to sit down with an accountant, preferably a CPA in business, with specializes in business tax, with myself or with other attorneys, with other specialists, marketers, whatever it may be that's particularly helpful for that business. Because a team approach is just vital in today's specialized economy. The types of mistakes that I want to hinge on are those that I've seen most often. I've seen them from two perspectives. One is the planning side of my practice, where I sit down with people and help them start their business entity, decide what entity to choose, and decide how to, go forward with their business based on their ideas, their aptitudes, and their skills, and really what the market is. And then I also have another perspective, and that is as a litigator. I do a lot of commercial litigation. I'm in the court a lot. And I'm there primarily on business cases. And I'll tell you, as a business person, as an entrepreneur, you don't want to be there. Okay? So if you can avoid being there, and if there are simple, almost common sense steps you can take to avoid being there, why wouldn't you do that? It's kind of like training all year long for a marathon and getting at the start line, but you didn't tie your shoes. It's just so almost stupid mistakes in some cases. And a lot of it is just common sense planning, having a backup plan, having a little bit of planning. So that you don't panic. I'll give you an example, small example. This evening, after I left my office, I ran home. and got ready to come back down here. I couldn't find my wallet. So in my wallet, you know, are my credit cards, my cash, a couple other items. And I'm getting ready to go out of town in a couple days. I'm going to need those things. Even if I lost them and could call the bank, I'd be without them. So I could either panic, run around, figure out, you know, where in the world is my wallet and get all out of control, and or I could have a backup plan. So I panicked because I didn't have a backup plan. But you need to have a backup plan in business. And I found my wallet, by the way. So the key to really running your business is to do what you do best. If you're a consultant, or if you're a manufacturer, or if you're a service provider, that's what you want to spend your time on. If you have a sales business, you want to be out there selling. So, you know, why do you want to sit around and go see a lawyer and deal with all these little details? Well, the reason is because if you do that, if you take a few days or moments, hours, whatever it may be, it's generally not much work to do preventative types of planning. You can avoid all the distractions. You can be walking around feeling good, everything's going well, and that could be you. Okay? Now, you can look at that and say, which one are you? Are you the potato or are you the masher? Okay? But if you're the potato and everything's going fine, but around the corner this guy's lurking there ready to smash you, you know, you may have some way to avoid that. You may have put in place a management team, or you may have put in place your documentation. You may have failed to do that. And if you fail to do those things that we're going to talk about, you might end up in litigation. Or if you're in litigation, you might end up giving your opponent a lot of ammunition. I had a jury trial earlier this year, or I should say last year, in 2013, that, by the way, took a week, which is a week of my client's time to be in court, and several days before that, over a two-year period in depositions. It was a huge distraction, a diversion, an enormous expense for his business. And he prevailed, but he prevailed because his partner, who we ended up suing, failed to do a lot of the things we're going to talk about. And he left us with all kinds of fodder, all kinds of ammunition to prove our case. It was a partnership dispute, an LLC dispute, and we were able to get around almost every point we needed to prove by using his own paperwork, or in most cases his lack of proper paperwork. So that being said, I'm going to jump into the outline, and the first item, areas that could be easily overlooked, has to do with licensing. And there's a bit of overlap in some of my slides here. In licensing, government regulation, statutory compliance, they all kind of overlap. But there are a surprising number of businesses that need to have some licenses and often start, I see this all the time, where they've started business and didn't get their license. And it may be a simple thing like a vendor's license, it may be a health department license if it's a business, a food business. I've had clients over the years. I've had a lot of cosmetology clients, and they have a licensing scheme where every year they have to renew. And there's some of those are pretty large businesses these days, and every single employee has to be licensed. So somebody has to manage that, and it's very easy to miss a deadline. It's getting less common now because the state licensing departments, for the most part, are online. They send people reminders. People don't move their businesses as frequently now, or if they do, it's easier to catch up. But it sounds like something you say, well, why would somebody not do that? Well, it happens all the time. I've had at least a dozen business clients who have lost their restaurant business because they failed to renew their liquor license on time. Okay, it fell through the cracks. They didn't have a team in place or a management plan in place. They're busy managing the restaurant. They know the renewal is coming up, but they fail to take care of it. And it happens more often than you would think. And when it happens and I get involved, that's something I can sometimes get around and save them a penalty or help them get a renewal or help them stay in business during the interim or counsel them what to do and how to continue to operate without that license if they can. With sales licenses, if you don't, and one of the topics we're going to get to, if you lose your sales license, the state of Ohio will come out, a vendor's license, and they'll tag your business and they'll tag your cash register if they can, and if you have one, and you won't be able to do any business. So it's just a simple, stupid mistake if it happens to you, but it can be very easily prevented just by having a sort of a calendar of events and not worrying about how to operate without a license when it's so easy to maintain one. You're not going to be surprised to hear a lawyer say, get it in writing, put it in writing. But documentation and failing to document your business in all sorts of areas is probably, again, it's probably the second largest area of litigation that I get involved in, that I see. This starts with when you start your business. I know you've probably had people come and talk to you about setting up sole proprietorship or corporations or LLCs, limited liability company, and those various entities, how to determine which entity to pick. But doing those, any of those steps, any of those types of businesses and business formations, it's important that you do it in the right order. And if you're going to set up an LLC, you don't want to go to the bank first and open up your bank account and then come back later and convert it. Because when you open the bank account, you have to give them a tax ID number. And if you get your tax ID number before you set up your LLC, it's going to be the wrong ID number. It's going to have the wrong name, maybe your name. And Ohio and every other state in the United States offers businesses the protections of corporate formation and limited liability formation, limited partnership formation. And those are designed to foster business and cooperative business investment, but they're also designed to protect the assets of the entrepreneur. So if you don't take advantage of those laws and follow the documentation practices, you're going to lose the benefit of having a corporation or a limited liability company. Those provide what we call a veil, a corporate veil, limited liability veil, so that if you have a limited liability company, for example, which is very simple to set up, and you've documented it properly, you've established it by proper filing with the Secretary of State of Ohio, and you've properly documented it with an operating agreement, which, by the way, is not a mandatory thing to have, but if you don't have it, you don't really have a limited liability company when you get to court. You have the uphill burden if you don't have one of those documents in place to prove that you're a liability company limited to the assets of that company rather than operating as your own sole proprietorship. That can make a big difference if, for example, I was starting to mention the case I just had last fall that we went to a jury. We were able to pierce that limited liability veil and prove that our adversary was really, his personal assets were available to my client in that lawsuit because the other guy failed to document his limited liability company. Now, getting documentation is also important in every other aspect of business. I've had a lot of clients over the years, some surprisingly large enterprises, who have prided themselves on never having a written contract for any of their business. I had a construction company client that was doing major steel erection work for like the football stadiums and baseball stadium in Cleveland and large projects like that on a handshake, and been doing it that way for 40 years. And he found himself in court, and I remember him telling me, he says, Mark, we just do everything on a handshake. It's trust. And, well, that's nice, but that's really not the way it operates anymore in this day and age, unfortunately. That would be nice if it did operate that way, if business could be run that way. And many businesses can, and a lot of you can carry on your enterprises without having to contract everything you do. But in that case, it was pivotal that there was no written documentation because there were no details that anybody agreed on. So we spent days in court trying to convince a judge what those details should be. And it was costly for my client. It was mostly time-consuming and annoying for him. And we prevailed, but it wasn't like he got ahead by prevailing. He got where he was back to where he should have been had he not been there in the first place. And had he just simply had a 5 or 6 page contract, and in his case, it would have been a boilerplate contract. It wouldn't even have cost him much to prepare. He could have probably avoided the entire lawsuit. It would have, and had he been sued anyhow, the case probably would have been resolved by a summary judgment or a dismissal early on. So it's really the saddest thing for me when I see that there hasn't been any documentation of any kind that helps establish just basic facts of your business. Last week, Friday of last week, I closed on a sale of a small business here in town. And they bought the business, my clients bought that business about 12 years ago, and they were not my clients at the time. And they became my clients shortly after that. And I asked them, as we were doing this closing, as they were selling their business, what documentation do you have when you bought it? And by the way, where's your, they were a limited liability company selling all of their assets. I said, where's your operating agreement? And what assets are you selling? Do we have a list of that? They had to scramble for 48 hours to get all that documentation together Thursday and Friday of last week, or they would have lost an opportunity that probably would not have come back again to sell their business because they didn't have that documentation that really, had they done it 12 years ago when they set up the business, might have cost them $300 or $400 and a couple hours of their time. And they salvaged it. We were able to salvage it, I think because they ended up having to discount the price a little bit. But it also costs them a lot more money now to go back and have that all papered, as we call it, just to get it taken care of, and provide them with the maximum tax advantage. They're going to lose a certain amount of tax advantage from selling their business because they didn't have that documentation as well. They're going to lose out on some of the distinction between capital gain and regular income. What I'm really striving is what Franklin always is famously attributed to saying about an ounce of prevention. It's worth a pound of cure. If you're coming to see me before you start your business or see some business advisor or other attorney or accountant for some good advice pre-enterprise planning, that's your ounce of prevention. If you're coming to see me after stuff's hit the fan and you're on your way to the courthouse or some protracted potential litigation, then you're talking about pounds and pounds of cure. With statutory compliance, it's the same thing. Statutory compliance in Ohio, again, it could be from anything as simple as, for example, telephone solicitation. If you have a business that has marketing and does telephone solicitation, there's a few statutes in Ohio that govern how you do that. It doesn't take long to find out what they are. You might find them out on your own if you want to search. You could, if you have an attorney, you can talk to your attorney. And if they do small business, they'll probably know. If you're in home repair, remodeling, construction, that kind of work, or any kind of home services that might be, there are a lot of those businesses I've represented. There's a couple forms that they have, a couple of statutes that apply to the forms they use, their contracts with their clients, their customers. If they don't have language in the Ohio statute on their forms, they are really risking working for free because the homeowner can turn around and sue them under the various statutes in Ohio that cover home solicitation sales. And if they haven't put that language like on the back of their contract that says you have 3 days to cancel and that sort of thing, they might not be able to collect if they don't get paid. And I've had that happen. I had a client, we went to a trial. He did a beautiful remodeling job for a client here in town. In her home, he had done her business downtown, did about an $80,000 renovation in one of the downtown businesses inside. Everything went great. She hired him for her house, and she didn't, due to other circumstances involved that had to do with her family, she didn't pay him for the remodeling in her house for about $25,000, $30,000. And we had to take her to court. And we had a jury trial, and we won. But her attorney took it to the Court of Appeals on a technicality saying that his contract, my client's contract, didn't have the language required by Ohio statute for home solicitation sales. And we argued that that didn't apply, did not apply to him. The Court of Appeals said, yes, it did apply to him. He didn't have the language. She doesn't have to pay him. Okay? Now, that was 2.5 years after we started that lawsuit. So imagine you're trying to run a business and you get distracted by something that simple. That he wasn't my client until he came to me to collect the money that he was owed. If he, had he come to me early on, I would have asked him right off the bat, do you have this language on your contract? Well, he didn't even have a contract. He just wrote it on a napkin and she signed it, and that was how he did business. But he doesn't do it that way anymore. The statutes in Ohio, when I talk about statute, I'm primarily talking about Ohio statute. They're generally specific to your industry. Ohio has about, last count, about 40 categories of statutes that could apply to various professions, occupations, and they don't apply to a lot of the more popular new enterprises, technology enterprises so much, but they can. There can be a lot of overlap. Like I said, the ounce of prevention, these statutes primarily are very rarely is it difficult to comply in advance. It might be a slight inconvenience, but it generally is not expensive. It's generally not difficult, just a little bit of paperwork. But they're often very onerous if you don't comply and you end up getting caught either by the government or by some customer or client or even an employee in some cases. The next area where we get into real costly mistakes, and this one is really almost any one of these categories could be a separate seminar by themselves, but succession planning. It's more than just getting, you know, your kids ready to take over your business. And a lot of you, if you have a business and you have kids, you know they're not going to be the person to take over your business. But if you have a good, viable business, and it's not just a personal, you know, service industry just related to you particularly, and you think you might have something that can be sold and carried on if you have a viable enterprise of that kind, then it's important to have the kind of succession that this cartoon indicates, who's going to take over when I'm not here. But that also applies, succession planning also applies to who's going to operate your business if you're incapacitated, or who's going to operate your business if you want to expand and move on into a new field, but you want to keep that sort of a foundation or your bread and butter. Okay? I've done this myself. I've been somewhat of an entrepreneur over the years in various fields, and you know, my bread and butter has always been my law practice, but there's been times when I've gotten involved in real estate or I've gotten involved in some insurance-related businesses and collection-related businesses, and I've always had to, before I did that, make sure that somebody's watching the shop at my law office, because that's key. So that's part of succession planning, too. Who's going to be able to take over the day-to-day activities? And it's great to have that in place if you ever want to have a vacation. If you're an entrepreneur or sole proprietor, you work harder than almost anyone else. You may not feel like you're physically working all the time, or your friends and family may not think you're working if you're working out of your house, but you're working. And you're thinking about it at night, and you're thinking about it in the morning, and you're thinking about it on vacation. And it's hard to get away. So it's a good idea to have somebody or something in place, even for the temporary times when you want to move aside and do something else for a while, whether it's a vacation or some kind of new business. When you do the succession planning, whether it's for succession of your business to turn it over to somebody, again, you want to have it your documents in order. You want to have your paperwork just in good order. Last week, I was telling you about this little business we sold. It's a retail operation, so it had a lot of equipment and inventory. And had it been documented sooner, it would have cost my client a lot less to do the sale, because it was kind of a rushed sale. The buyer was very motivated, had time deadlines. And we had to go back, and my client had to really almost reinvent the wheel on his background of his business, all the documentation of who among he and his partners were the actual owners, what did each person own, and what was each person going to get out of it. In succession planning of a small business where there's more than one principal, it's very important, and I do this in LLCs all the time. We do buy-sell agreements between the owners where if one party wants to leave the business, you should have it in writing when you start the business. And you really need to do it before you start business because it can happen on day two or it can happen on, you know, 12 years later. But if you don't have an agreement in place, it can really foul up the business, particularly if it was a partnership type of situation where you had key employees and one of them's leaving. It's very simple to write up a buy-sell agreement or a close corporation agreement, depending on the type of business entity you have. But that can set up the rules in advance for what happens if one of the owners dies. What happens if one of the owners gets divorced and their ownership is now suddenly in the hands of an ex-spouse or something, if there's a divorce and a death, which is, these things happen all the time. They're just ordinary life occurrences. And when it's like passing away without a will, there's no reason for it. If you have the documentation in place, then you're saving whoever's left behind or yourself a tremendous headache. As far as the next topic, regulatory compliance, that kind of overlaps with the statutory schemes that Ohio has. But in regulatory compliance, I'm also talking here about the federal government, the local government, in Ohio we have county government that has a series of rules. If you're doing, for example, if you're in this county, in Summit County, and you're doing any building, you may be subject to the Summit County Building Department rules. You may be subject to the city's local city rules, depending what city you're in. So you have to be able to know where to go, who to talk to if you're planning to expand, particularly if you're doing any type of enterprise that's subject to these kind of regulations. There are, again, a whole host of those, and I'm not going to go into all the details of them. But I've seen over and over again just kind of ignorant mistakes. You know, all know, you know, ignorance of the law is no defense. But typically, most regulatory agencies are, you know, government workers. They're generally friendly people. They're generally willing to help you for the most part, as long as you're not, you know, in their face and, you know, defiant as to why you need to comply. And maybe you don't need to comply, but my experience has always been that it's almost always easier to work things out in advance and to go to them in advance before you start doing what you're doing. It keeps me employed, so I don't mind if people don't do it, but it happens all the time where, you know, somebody will start building a building and they won't have the permits, or they'll clear land and they don't have zoning approval, or they'll start operating, low-level businesses, landscaping, for example, and they don't have a landscaper's chemical applicator's permit. You have to have one. They might not know that, but they should know it. And if they don't know it, they probably are not telling me the truth, because you can't go buy the chemicals without showing them your license. But it happens anyhow. It happens all the time. So you can be shut down. I had a radon back when radon testing was kind of all the rage in the 80s and 90s. The state of Ohio regulates radon inspectors. And I had a guy that was doing 10, 12 a day, but his license had expired. And he was in violation of the license rule. He was in violation of the state and federal regulations concerning radon inspection. And not only did he have to pay a fine, he had to refund all the money he gave for everyone that every job he did when he was out of compliance. And he wanted to challenge it and felt he had some defense. His defense was meritless, but he wanted to press it. And He spent 2 days in Columbus at an administrative hearing, and he lost. And he, you know, it didn't go well. And all he had to do was just really consult with somebody ahead of time, fill out a paperwork, pay $140 or whatever the fee was, and it would have avoided all of that problem. And he was very good at what he did. He just wasn't good at keeping his paper and his paper in order, his paperwork. Those, again, they seem stupid that you think, who would not do these things? Why? Common sense says, you know, you would take care of this, but it happens all the time, and it can happen by oversight. It can happen because you're too busy and you're too successful and you're not watching these little details. That's why it's good to have, you know, some kind of accountant you can pick up the phone, an attorney you can pick up the phone, somebody who's a business consultant who can just, you know, say, are you, you know, or somebody who's managing your business sort of behind the scenes, helping you out. These are all great ideas if you have your own great idea and you just want to run with it and not be mired in the details. One of the areas that I enjoy the most in terms of litigating and drafting the preventative side is confidential, proprietary, and trade secrets. And Ohio, for example, like most states, has its own set of laws that protect your trade secrets. It protects the theft of trade secrets. It makes it criminal, in fact, if one enterprise or individual steals another's trade secrets. But the key to that is, how do they define the trade secret? And that's a defined term in Ohio law and in federal law. And I'm not going to give you a full definition of it, but it's because it's something you can simply look up. It's pretty easy to look up. But confidential, proprietary, and trade secrets are often, in today's economy, the number one asset of your business. And if you haven't protected them, and you have employees who can walk away with those, or you have customers who can walk away with those, you're pretty much giving away the shop. One of my clients manufactures chemical adhesives, and one of his most profitable products over the last 12 years has been, because of federal regulations with regard to volatile chemicals, it's very important now that all chemicals manufacturers are making a lot of what are called, I forgot the term, but it's not non-volatile chemicals. And removing oil from paint, for example, and making all paint latex and water-based is an example. And as a result, there's been a lot of chemical invention, particularly in this area. Akron in particular has the polymer industry and produces an offshoot of many, many small businesses. One of those businesses, a client of mine, makes a cement that's used in the tire manufacturing business. And he had the only cement in the world for a dozen years that had no VOCs in it. It was zero VOCs. So you could put it in your tire manufacturing plant and reduce your emissions instantly. And that was very important. Not as much as important in the United States as it was in Europe, where the laws are much stricter. The environmental law regulation in Europe is extremely stricter than it is in the United States. So we had to send out this product to all these European tire manufacturers and let them test it in their manufacturing plant to see if it would work for them. But we knew that they all had chemistry labs, and they could reverse engineer it, because it wasn't all that complicated of a process once you had the basics of that type of thing. My client was a specialist in that. So we had to send out, every time we sent out a little sample, it'd be a little 6-ounce sample, and they could test it on a couple of tires. We'd have a contract that weighed more than the sample, because we wanted them to make sure that they understood that we weren't letting them use this unless they signed that contract, and that contract was ironclad and was enforceable not only in this country but in their country as well. And that took some of them aback. They said, well, we don't do that. It was a company in Spain or Portugal, I forget where it was, said, well, we won't sign the contract, but we'll give you a huge order. Well, we wouldn't do that. My client wouldn't do that because he can't let it out the door. He knew it was too valuable. He had a patent in it, all that, but you don't want to chase somebody for a patent. That takes 15, 20 years sometimes. So We had that done. Every document in your business is not confidential. You might think it's confidential, but if you really want to protect it, you have to tell everybody it's confidential. So go to Office Max and spend $4 and buy a stamp that says confidential and mark what you really want to be confidential. Mark it that way so that your assistant or the kid that works for you over the summer or your business partner who leaves you or your specialist tech guy or chemist or whoever it might be quits and goes to work somewhere else, they know that that information is protected. You need to have written policies for your documentation, for your trade secrets and your proprietary information. You need to have that, and you need to have some acknowledgement when you hire people that they are going to be given information which is very sensitive, which is confidential and or proprietary or trade secret, and let them know in advance that, you know, you'll prosecute, your severance packages, whatever, they're all contingent on them not violating any of those agreements. And, you know, most people are honorable. Most people will sign that. Most people will acknowledge that. But you have to be proactive. You can't just assume that I came up with this process and therefore it's mine. If you want your price list of your service that you sell or your client list to be confidential, you need to make some effort to establish it that it is confidential. If you're in the business of selling to window manufacturers, your customer list isn't confidential. Anyone can go get a directory and find all the window manufacturers. But if you have names of the contact people, the buyers, what their kids' names are and what their golf handicap is, and you have all these things that you may have developed over a period of years, that's proprietary information. And you can protect that. You can keep that from walking out the door. And you should. You should keep it from going out the door because you probably have underestimated the value of it to your business. Or if you haven't, if you appreciate the value of it, you need to take some steps to protect it. The next area of mistakes I see often in my practice are where people, businesses, I should say, violate or try to violate these three items: the restraints on competition, unfair trade practices, and antitrust monopoly law. For most small businesses, these seem to be distant, obscure concepts, but they can come into play, particularly the restraints on competition. If you have some kind of an agreement with your supplier or one of your customers, you have to be a little cautious that you're not restraining fair competition, that you don't have some special deal that sort of borders on a overstepping of Ohio law. There's Ohio law that restricts unfair competition. A good example was back in the 80s in Ohio, the grocery chains in Cleveland got involved in what I think it was just called price fixing. And there was a huge class action suit. And those of you that lived in Ohio back then may remember, everybody got little coupons that you could use for $5 or $10. You'd get some, like every 6 months, you'd get coupons for a couple of years. That was a multi-million dollar settlement of grocery chains that restrained fair competition by fixing prices for certain grocery items. And they got caught, and they got prosecuted both criminally and civilly. As far as I know, there's no corporations in any jails in the United States yet, but the Supreme Court said a corporation's a person, so sooner or later something's going to happen. But the monetary fines were enormous in that case, and the monetary fines paled in comparison to the legal expenses. They were just a fraction of what they ended up expending in the actual legal costs, not just attorney fees, but the cost of, to have the executives in court and in depositions and turning over all their records for years that it went on. So these areas are areas that you should be thinking about if you're involved in any kind of activity that might have to do with fixing prices or collusion of prices. And I don't mean that you're going to go out and intentionally do those things, but it's if you're dealing with a supplier, for example, and you have an exclusive agreement with somebody, words like exclusive, words like, well, exclusive is one of the key words. Words like competitive pricing, things like that that you might see in contracts, you should those should raise an eyebrow, that you should just double check and make sure you're not violating anything like that. With insurance, with small business, there are a lot of areas where simple, small, low-price insurance policy is a really good idea. And I've had case after case where it hasn't been purchased, and it's kind of a tragedy in the sense of the customer or the client of mine has undergone a change of life. There's been a death in the family, or there's been a fire in the business, an accident, and they didn't have insurance for it. If you have a buy-sell agreement and you have a business partner and your business is absolutely dependent on that partner being involved and something happens to them, if you're not insured for, if the business isn't insured for their death, you know, you can take, it's a double whammy. You lose a partner, but you might end up losing, you know, the key part of your business. It doesn't cost a lot, generally, to get these policies if you get them early on. You can also get what's called key man insurance, key person insurance, and that'll often, there are policies available that will provide money for a buyout, if there's going to be a buyout, and it can be triggered by certain events. There are, as this cartoon talks about, an umbrella policy. Umbrella policies are relatively cheap. You talk to most insurance agents, you can get $1 million umbrella coverage for a few hundred dollars a year. And that can cover you against whatever might fall under that umbrella. So it's a good idea to have it. If you are just starting your business, this is not something you necessarily have to have from the day one, but it's a good idea as soon as you reach a point of viability and profitability. You can also have business interruption insurance. Those are less common these days, but there are casualty-related policies that will protect some cash flow for your business in the event of casualty that's insurable, you know, depending on if you have like a business with heavy equipment, heavy-duty or expensive equipment that can be damaged due to a casualty, or your real estate is critical to your business if you're, say, a retail establishment or a warehouse or something like that. And this topic is really one that almost defies common sense, why you wouldn't pay your taxes. But it happens so frequently, and it happens so quickly to a lot of businesses. I have one business that right now, almost every day I find out another tax that they haven't paid, and how they're staying in business is beyond me, but they're not going to for very long. This happens a lot in the food industry. This happens a lot in small cash-related businesses type enterprises, where the business, if you have employees, you're required to withhold and deposit your payroll deductions for FICA and FUTA and workers' comp and those sorts of things. And it's so easy to set aside an account and pay these accounts each time, but when you don't pay them, it can cause enormous problems. First problem is it can become personal to you. And that's where we talk about the corporate shield and the LLC veil and those sorts of things. There's an exception to those. There's no veil, there's no shield when the tax man is involved, because you can't even get a tax ID number without giving the IRS your Social Security number to begin with. Somebody is a responsible person in every business, and that responsible person is usually the owner. And if it's not the owner, IRS can get to the owner, because that's really who is under their laws and their regs are is responsible. So they can get to you, and they can, for example, charge 15% penalty for not paying your withholding tax. So that adds up real fast, even with small salaries, even with minimum wage. It can add up very fast, and then you're running behind and you're in the hole. I've seen it happen with a lot of startups, because they don't get their accounting in place, and they figure they'll get to it and then something comes up and they need some cash and they put a, you know, they spend out and they say, well, I'll catch up next time. And the government will let you go for a couple of years. They'll just file liens against you and file liens against you and file liens against you. And then finally, they'll come in and enforce those liens. And when they do that, you're done. You're out of business. So it's just one of those things, like I said at the beginning, there are a lot of things that seem to be just common sense, but they happen. They happen all the time, that people forget to take care of them or neglect to take care of them. And I've seen some really nice businesses, long-standing family businesses, go under because of that. I've talked about this a lot. It's one that I can't stress enough. You need to get a lot of things in writing whenever you can. It doesn't have to be long. I like 2-page contracts. I write a lot of those. It just has to spell out the terms, and just has to be something that you can point to later if there's a dispute that says, what are we doing? What am I selling and what are you buying? What are we paying? What happens if this happens? What happens if that happens? It doesn't have to have a whereas and therefore and all that stuff in it, legalese. It just has to be a memorialization of your transaction. And it's a good idea to have it with the customers, with your suppliers, with your employees, and then really with everybody you do business with. And again, it can be something you write yourself. It can be something that maybe it can be something you find on the internet. There are an improving quality of contracts online. A lot of them can get you into trouble because they're not specific to your state or your situation. But it's really, from my perspective, it's one of the most important things you can do, because if you come to me and you have a problem, the first question I have is, well, what documentation do you have? Otherwise, I have he said versus she said, or something like that, and we're in court, and we don't have any paperwork to support what we're talking about. And jurors and judges, they think everybody has contracts. What do you mean you don't have a contract? So they think something's wrong right off the bat if you don't have one. So it's just simpler to have it in advance, have a form, particularly if there's something you're doing on a routine basis. If you have regular lots of repeat business with new customers, or you have a lot of the same kind of work, you can come up with a form agreement, and you can fill in the blanks, and that can work just fine for most things. But if you think about who are the most successful companies in the world, okay? If I said, does anyone here think Microsoft is a successful company, or GM is a successful company? Do you think you can get a Microsoft product legally without signing a contract? And you can't even understand their contracts, but you have to sign that license agreement and agree every single time. That's a contract. When you hit that agree button, after you scroll down all those things you didn't read, you're signing a contract. Okay, and Microsoft doesn't let you look at any of their product unless you've agreed. And every software company does that. And you can't get a car from GM without signing a 4-page contract. You can't do anything with those successful companies. And they do that for a reason. And the reason is that protects them in the event of some dispute down the road. And with most businesses, you have an advantage. You don't have to sign some big, long form. You can control what it says, particularly if it's your contract and you're giving it to your supplier or your vendor or your employees. Employees, a whole other topic in and of itself, and we're going to talk briefly about it. We're going to talk about it before we get to that. In Ohio, I'll touch this real quickly. You don't have to have a contract of employment, whether you're an employee or an employer. Ohio is what's called an at-will employment state. Most of you probably know that. It means at-will employment simply means you're free to leave anytime you want as an employee, and your employer's free to let you go at any time for no reason, for no cause. If you're at-will, you don't have a contract. But the exception to those are people that, A, have a written employment agreement, which is very important for a lot of categories of employees. If you're hiring a tech person or you're hiring a financial person, or you're hiring anyone with any kind of expertise, and anyone who's capable of damaging your business by taking your knowledge, or your trade secrets or your confidential information. Those people ought to be under some type of a contract. It could be a non-compete agreement. It could be an employment agreement that has a non-compete agreement in it. It could be a confidentiality agreement, or it could be sort of comprehensive of all those things. But if somebody is employed at will and there's no contract and they haven't signed any confidentiality agreement and you don't have an employee handbook that defines the employment relationship, then you're sort of out there in the cold with what it is you want to do to protect your business. So none of these are rocket science. You don't have to be reinvented each time. They're pretty much standard forms for most businesses. You can customize them for your business. But they're well worth it, particularly in the term of preventative. It's just preventative law is what it is. And it's invaluable. I'd much rather write somebody an agreement than have to litigate that agreement down the road, or litigate some issue that arose because they didn't have the agreement. So now we'll go to questions, because those are really the top. It was supposed to be a top 10 list, but I lost count. I think it was 12 or 13 maybe. So anyhow, does anybody have any kind of questions? Good. I guess not then. Well, thank you for staying awake, those of you that stayed awake. And thanks for coming out in this bad weather.